From Nevada Public Radio, I'm Paul Boger. This is KNPR State of Nevada. Red light running, speeding, disregarding school zones, and tailgating. All facets of driving in Nevada that, unfortunately, most of us have grown accustomed to. But there are many times when bad driving can turn dangerous, even deadly. And across the state, those instances are up 46% since 2013, with no sign of slowing. That's one of the many findings UNLV's Kirkorian School of Medicine made in its Nevada Road Users Database Traffic Study. The study is entering its 14th year. It was just awarded $650,000 by the state to continue studying and hopefully preventing crashes. UNLV professor and acute care surgery chief Deborah Cools is the study's principal investigator. She sat down with KNPR producer Ann Davis to unpack those traffic fatality stats.
Dr. Cools, welcome back to State of Nevada.
Thank you.
So in 2024, Nevada recorded 421 traffic fatalities. So the obvious question to start off with is, you know, why do we have so many injuries and deaths on our roads here?
What we know is that motor vehicle crashes and those that are deadly are very much related to speed, impaired driving, reckless driving, aggressive driving, and other behavioral issues. And this accounts for over 50% of traffic-related crashes.
So what is causing the other 50% of these crashes?
So the other 50% can really have to do with, you know, road conditions, weather conditions, and other factors that really are not in a driver's control.
Vegas is a city that sees about 50 traffic accidents or crashes every single day. Based on what you see, you know, in the ER dealing with patients, what injuries do people who've been in car or motorcycle crashes come in with?
I would sort of categorize traffic crashes into what we call vulnerable road users, and they would be pedestrians, bicyclists, and motorcyclists. These days, like electrical bicycles, electric skateboards, and so forth would fall into that category. So if any of those vulnerable road users are involved in a crash, you know, often they're actually hit by another vehicle, not always, but usually the complete force of that motor vehicle that hits them is directly transferred, if you will, to the human body, as opposed to if there's a motor vehicle crash with two, let's say, automobiles crashing into one another, while there's still a tremendous amount of force and there can be horrible injury, the automobiles are manufactured to have many safety features to help either prevent injury or decrease the severity of injury. So the crashes that involve the vulnerable road users, including pedestrians, are really horrific. I would say it is rare that someone comes into us that's been a vulnerable road user, and it would be rare that they actually don't have any injuries. But the less injured probably have extremity fractures, which are totally disabling, right, and prevent people from being able to work. But I think more importantly, they really end up with head-to-toe injuries. And, you know, if they're not wearing a helmet, and like pedestrians are not typically wearing helmets, you know, brain injuries, spinal cord injuries that may leave them paralyzed, internal injuries that may cause them to actually bleed to death before they can get to the hospital, or if they get to the hospital, require emergency surgery, emergency blood to try to save their lives. And many are not able to return to their normal lives. In motor vehicle crashes, we also see people speeding, and if both cars are speeding, the force is more than just like you add up the force of A plus B. It's actually a multiplicative factor.
I do want to ask, what's the most surprising statistic you've uncovered as part of your research for this study?
I would say there are many statistics that are surprising. One is the number of people who are unrestrained. And in other words, don't wear their seat belts. You know, we as individuals, we drive around, we typically don't look in the other vehicle, right? But the percentage of deaths associated with people who do not wear their seat belts or not restrained is huge. That is probably one of the easiest correctable behaviors as well that, you know, can often result in death.
Yeah, something as simple as just putting on a seatbelt before you start the car or get out of the driveway. UNLV received funding to continue this research that you're doing, and that was about $650,000. Is that enough to fund just this year's work or beyond that?
So it is a one-year grant, and really what we're trying to do with our grant is bring in into play multiple data sources. So we're really trying to develop a complete picture of kind of the profile of the driver, if you will, in terms of their driving record, and a complete look at from the scene all the way to hospital discharge, what happens to the people who are injured.
Back to your research, your colleagues have found some pretty shocking statistics, including this one, you know, that rising numbers of traffic injuries and deaths cost the state about $16 billion, with a B, billion dollars in 2023. That would really seem to be a strong incentive for officials to beef up their traffic safety efforts. So have they?
Yes. One of the issues is the magnitude of the challenge is so significant that even our governor, I believe it was before the legislature started, actually advocated for automated enforcement, feeling that, you know, the amount of speeding that goes on, and I'll just call it racing through intersections and many times through a light that turns from yellow to red or is already red at the beginning of crossing the intersection, that behavior is so prevalent that I think it's just almost impossible for law enforcement to really have enough law enforcement agents to really curb the issue.
Deborah Cools is the Associate Dean of Research at the Kirk Kerkorian School of Medicine and Chief of Trauma at University Medical Center. She is also the Principal Investigator with UNLV's Nevada Road Users Database Traffic Study. Dr. Cools, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Officials in Northern Nevada say it's hard to find the space to add more housing. Sun Valley, just outside Reno, is one area that still has room for growth. But as KUNR's Burt Johnson reports, its residents are losing vital services.
Reina Navanez has been going to Scaleri's Food and Drug Store on Sun Valley Boulevard for a long time.
I used to work here, actually, like a decade ago, which is pretty cool.
But this Scaleri's run, on a Tuesday afternoon in mid-August, was to be Alvanez's last. That's because the locally owned grocery chain shut down last month after more than 70 years in business.
It's a bit of a ding. Scaleri's had like the best prices as far as the area went. It was just the place you went to when you wanted like a good price, something reasonable.
The closure left Sun Valley without its own grocery store, even as the population continues to grow. Now, residents must travel up to 5 miles for fresh, healthy food, often in stop-and-go traffic. So they're hoping more investment comes to their community soon.
It's like we get ignored. You know, they don't care.
Heidi Soper is chair of the Sun Valley Citizens Advisory Board, and she's lived here since the 80s. In that time, she's watched Sun Valley's population explode. But for decades, Scaleri's remained the only grocery store, meaning even before it closed, the community was a federally designated food desert. The U.S. Department of Agriculture defines food deserts as low-income areas where at least a third of the residents have limited access to healthy food. That can lead people to rely on overpriced convenience stores and fast food chains. But Soper says Scaleri's was much more than a place to get groceries. It was a community hub where people went to play slots and catch up. In fact, she was there hanging out when she first learned the store was closing.
I put my $5 in the slot machine, and she goes, oh, we're closing. I went, excuse me? She goes, yeah, the store is closing. I went, oh, geez.
As soon as Soper heard the news, she went to Washoe County Commissioner Mariluz Garcia.
I think we've already seen the damaging effects of not having a really strong anchor store and a really strong anchor bank that has kept up with the times and been able to revitalize itself.
Garcia lives in Sun Valley, too. And since it's unincorporated, she's the only local official representing the community. So Garcia's working with other policymakers like State Senator Angie Taylor to try and find a new store to take over the old space.
The traffic back up there alone, right, will show us that the growth out there is tremendous.
Taylor says all that growth makes it especially troubling to see Sun Valley lose its only grocery store. During the last legislative session, she co-sponsored a measure that could have helped places like Scolari's stay open. But the bill died without a vote, so she's looking ahead to 2027.
People are going to continue to need more help. And our job as a legislature is to provide that help if there's any way that we can.
Meanwhile, Garcia wants to build on the old grocery store's role as a community hub. She'd like to see part of the massive parking lot become a venue for local food trucks.
I would love to create a space that people would be drawn to and have this parking lot activated into a gathering place for families to come not only get a great bite to eat, but to socialize.
Back in Sun Valley, Heidi Soper welcomes that idea, but for now, she's still worried about the impact of losing Scolari's.
This is going to be very traumatic for this community.
After all, she says, Sun Valley residents pay their taxes just like anyone else, and they deserve the same access to essential services. Bert Johnson, KUNR News.
This is KNPR State of Nevada. I'm Paul Boger. Since mid-July, five inmates have died at High Desert State Prison, about an hour northwest of Las Vegas. Another was killed at nearby Southern Desert Correctional Center. At this time, the deaths are still under investigation, but Department of Corrections staff have already linked some of the deaths to drug debt. Brian Horwath is a breaking news reporter who has kept on top of this for the Las Vegas Review-Journal. I spoke with him to get the latest on this developing story.
All right, Brian, thank you for talking with me today.
Glad to be here.
Going over the reporting from various news outlets, in addition to yours, the numbers seem to be all over the place. Deaths happen all the time in prison. How many of these recent deaths are confirmed, and how many are under investigation?
Well, there's several that are still being investigated. There's two or three that have been called suspicious, but there's also a handful just in the past couple months here that have been labeled as homicides, and we're talking about mostly young prisoners who are under the age of 40 in their 20s or their 30s. And, you know, that's one of the things that kind of stands out in our reporting is that a lot of these men are young, and, you know, some of them didn't have much time left at all on their sentences. So that stood out to us as well. And, you know, I think it goes without saying that any prison could be a dangerous place, you know, but what I'm hearing from people who have loved ones on the inside is that it's a pretty chaotic picture that they paint. You know, they're saying that there's not a lot of oversight, and there are certainly people out there who are worried about their loved ones who are in the Nevada Department of Corrections system.
What has the Department of Corrections had to say about these deaths at this point?
For the most part, they've said that a lot of these deaths are due to drug debts and things like that. They admit, they say that there's a problem with contraband, certainly at High Desert and some other facilities. So they're saying that, you know, altercations are happening because, you know, people might be using drugs, and of course, if drugs are in the prison, drugs are being dealt. There obviously can be disputes there for payment and whatnot. And they're saying, hey, look, the contraband in the system at High Desert specifically, it has been a problem. And, you know, they say that they're trying to combat that. They're trying to look at some different things. So, you know, we'll see what happens here. It's been kind of the last two or three months, it's been a steady stream of reported deaths. And you know, we're going to have to see if that continues throughout the rest of the year, and maybe if some of the things that they say they're changing might help.
Since July, three inmates in prisons in northern Nevada have also died. All of these were men under the age of 40. Are any of these deaths under investigation that you know of?
Yeah, as far as I know, they're all under investigation. And you know, we'd certainly like to learn more about, you know, what's happening here. And, you know, the trickle of information has been kind of slow from the Department of Corrections. Now, look, they're overseeing prisons where, you know, these are folks in a lot of cases that committed some pretty violent acts, some pretty heinous things. So we're not talking about choir boys. And when you put a bunch of people with that kind of history in the same place, you know, it's, you can see how things can happen. But I think what people who have loved ones in these facilities, what they're concerned about is the safety of their loved ones. And you know, I was talking to a woman whose husband was killed and under what they called suspicious circumstances just recently and at High Desert. And she said, you know, from what she could gather, it was kind of a situation where the inmates were running the facility, and there wasn't a whole lot of oversight. Now, you know, I'm not in there. We're not in there. We can't say for sure that is or isn't happening, but certainly there's issues, and certainly there's issues that, you know, you would think the Department of Corrections would want to remedy here. And they say they are. They say they're trying some different things to try to kind of get control of the situation. So we'll see.
Brian Horwath is a breaking news reporter for the Las Vegas Review-Journal. Brian, thank you so much.
Thank you.
As a note, KNPR did reach out to the Nevada Department of Corrections. They declined the opportunity to join us for this conversation. However, they did provide this statement from NDOC Director James Zarenda. The safety of offenders and staff remains the top priority of the Nevada Department of Corrections and High Desert State Prison. Currently, HDSP is in a no-movement status to ensure the safety. The facility has changed several protocols in managing the offender population. First, the number of offenders allowed out for recreation at one time has been significantly reduced, while still adhering to federal and local laws regarding out-of-cell time. This reduction will allow far more security protocols to be applied, including physical searches and scanning with walkthrough or handheld metal detectors to ensure no weapons are present when the offenders have physical access to each other or the staff. Additionally, the department has created a contraband task force to locate and remove items that contribute to safety concerns, such as prison-made weapons, narcotics, gang paraphernalia, and other forms of contraband. That, again, was a statement from Nevada's Corrections Department. This isn't the first time people have been killed while serving time in the state. Last year, three inmates at Ely State Prison were killed in what officials called a riot. The deaths raised questions about the high rate of violence within the state's Department of Corrections and what will staff do to protect those inmates and their care. With me to talk about that is Jody Hawking, the founder and executive director of Return Strong Nevada. That is an organization that advocates for incarcerated people and their families. Jody, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for inviting me, Paul. I appreciate it.
Multiple news outlets are reporting unsafe and unsanitary conditions inside Nevada prisons. Give us an example of what you're hearing from inmates and their families.
So just to clarify, like, we work directly with people who are incarcerated and their families and have a direct correspondence method with them. So we have a rapid response and they write to us. And what we're hearing overwhelmingly is that, I mean, there's a few things that we're hearing. One is that, and it's the no movement rule that's happening right now has really been going on for a long time. There's very limited movement. People are spending extended amounts of time in isolation, which isn't legally defined as solitary, but it actually is solitary, like confinement. So people are locked down for, you know, extended periods of time. And then when they come out, it's, you know, 118 degrees and people's tempers are flaring and they've been arguing back and forth across the cell wall, like hallways all day. And then when they get out, things, as they say all the time, is like then they pop off, right? Then there's fights and arguments that escalate quickly. The other thing that we hear is really a lack of like oversight with COs, that they're doing, COs are there are COs, I won't say all of them, but correctional officers are a part of what the problem are, either for not supervising, not intervening in the fights, not like doing anything to be proactively lowering the issues from happening. And sorry, there was another thing I was going to say and I forgot what it was.
That's okay. Let's talk about, you know, what we're hearing from NDOC itself. You know, talking to them, reading their statement, you know, they say that this is related to drug debts, that we are seeing an increase in contraband and paraphernalia in prisons. But you don't necessarily buy that explanation. Why not?
I don't. I mean, I think it's the easy answer is to say it's related to drug debt. Are drugs in prison a problem? Yes, they've always been a problem, and it's very likely that they will continue to be a problem. But the if you go through what each one of the deaths are, I'm in contact with the families, and I also have multiple people from inside prison with our rapid response program. We hear from witnesses like right away who are seeing what's going on, sometimes in real time. I know Jake Herman was killed, and what we're hearing is that was really a housing classification issue. Jake had 5 days left before he was going to be out. Maybe it was four, and he was housed with somebody. Both he and the other person had mental health issues. He was housed with somebody who had been very open about the fact that if they put somebody in the cell with him, he was going to do harm to them. And he was serving 2 life sentences. My understanding is life without websites down, so I can't double check that information, but that he was serving in prison, that housing class, that shouldn't have happened. And we hear frequently that a lot of these fights and murders are related to housing classifications that were incorrect and shouldn't have happened and put people at risk. You know, Jake had 5 days left. I received a letter that said they sold 2 people, one who had everything to lose and one who had nothing to lose. And the person who had everything to lose ended up dead, sadly. I could go through the list of the 5 people that are recent, and it's all similar stories, and not one of them that we can tell is actually related to drug debt or overdoses or any of those issues.
We're talking about the recent rash of violence in Nevada prisons. Since mid-July, 5 people have died at High Desert State Prison, about an hour northwest of Las Vegas. Prison officials say those deaths are under investigation, but have linked them to drug debts. As a note, KNPR did reach out to the Nevada Department of Corrections, which declined this opportunity to join the conversation, but you can read a statement that I read earlier. You'll be able to see that on our website at knpr.org. Also join me in welcoming Chris Peterson, legal director of the ACLU of Nevada, to the show. Chris, thank you for talking about this with us.
It's a pleasure to be here today, although the topic is obviously not pleasant.
You're looking at this from the legal standpoint. Let's start there. Does NDOC have an obligation to keep inmates safe?
Yes.
So
they're required by the U.S. Constitution and the Nevada Constitution to keep the people who are in their care safe.
So let's talk about that. You know, what are they required? What does that safety look like?
So I would start by saying courts give prisons a lot of leeway in how they carry out their job. But the Constitution puts a floor, right, a minimum of what we expect from our prisons. And to prevent cruel and unusual punishment, that's the term that's used in the Constitution. And what the courts look at is, one, did the prison fail in its duty to prevent reasonably foreseeable harm? That's the words that they use. And the way they break it down is say, look, was there an objective risk of substantial risk of harm? As in, was there a thing that it was in the universe that exists, a substantial risk that harm was going to happen? And the second step is, were the prison officials subjectively aware of it? Did they in fact know about this risk, right? Now, this is sometimes very hard to establish in a court of law. There's a lot of bad things that happen in prisons where no one's held accountable. But what we're seeing right now in the Nevada Department of Corrections seems to be satisfying that standard. And of course, we're doing more investigation organizations doing more investigation, working alongside organizations like Return Strong, and also doing our own public records requests and talking to families about what's happening there. But it definitely looks like there's a pattern of violence happening in the prisons, and that from what we're seeing, the people who are running those prisons are aware of that problem.
You're a former public defender. You've worked with the criminal justice system your entire career. What do you think is going on here? Why do you think there's been this uptick in violence?
So, I mean, we're still doing an investigation. I suspect there's probably many different factors that are playing a role. But, I mean, when you're talking about an aging prison system that isn't being properly staffed, and NDOC has been very upfront about not having proper staffing. I think the last numbers, my understanding was they had 50% of the staff that they needed to run their prisons, right? And then in turn, whether or not they, I don't know this for a fact, but of course, if they're not having good retention as far as staff is concerned for their corrections officers, folks that are experienced in managing and running a facility, I mean, you're going to have people get seriously hurt and killed that are going to be there, right? Obviously, Jody is very familiar with what's going on there. I mean, it's her organization's job to be in touch on the ground there. But we obviously are also aware of it because we look at it from the legal side. And this is basically a powder keg that's going off. It's not going to go off. It is going off, considering the number of murders that have happened in the facilities.
Jody, your organization works closely with the Nevada Department of Corrections and Director Zarenda. Have you spoken to him about all of this? You know, what does he say about what's going on in DOC?
I mean, I think NDOC in general is trying to figure out an answer. Even the statement that you read earlier lists a bunch of ways that they're trying to do something. But in my opinion, what is happening is we're putting Band-Aids on something that actually needs tourniquets. Like the problem is much bigger, and putting Band-Aids on, having task force on, a contraband task force, okay, is that task force also going to be addressing the ways that is how drugs are coming in? We are hearing constantly and have filed reports with the IG naming COs that are part of bringing things into the system, because we get that information from people and we try to be as transparent as we can in sharing what our concerns are and who we're concerned about with NDOC. I think we're missing the root of the problem. We're keeping people locked down 23 hours a day or more. Like, some people are spending days and days, weeks at a time without programming. I shared with you, my husband was at Southern Desert for many years, and the past, since COVID, he's like, all I did was sit in the hallway for the past 6 years. Like, literally no programming, no opportunity to program, no yard, no, like, nothing. So when we say we're limiting, you know, we're going to no movement, we're limiting the numbers of people that are out, those people weren't going out anyway. Like, that has been a problem for since COVID, maybe before that, but we started then, so I can't say before. We have to really get to the root of the problems. And that is not just NDOC. In my opinion, NDOC is the agent for the state. And if the state is choosing not to properly fund, not to properly staff, and from my understanding from conversations with NDOC and with the, listening to the legislature, is the staffing shortage is not coming. There's like this word game that's going on that they're not fully staffed, when really is they don't have enough posts, so they're not funded for the right number of people.
Jody, we have about a minute left. You know, people will say that some of these men are violent criminals, that they are in the criminal justice system, that they, you know, unfortunately, they, you know, bad things happen in prison and that they put themselves there. You know, what do you say when people make that argument to you?
So I think for me, for our organization, they are human beings. Many, many, many of them, if you look at the statistics, have come from backgrounds of trauma. And broken people break people. Like, I'm not excusing the actions. There needs to be accountability, but accountability and punishment are not the same thing. Punishing people with food, with violence, with losing their lives before they're supposed to, are all that's not what prison is for. I don't think that we use it correctly. And I think that we'll continue to see the types of problems that we're seeing if that's all we use to cure social problems.
That's where we're going to have to leave it for today. Chris Peterson is the legal director for the ACLU of Nevada. Jody Hocking is the founder and executive director of Return Strong Nevada. Thank you both so much.
Bye. Thank you.
Thank you.
Earlier, we heard from Brian Horwath of the Las Vegas Review-Journal. You're listening to KNPR State of Nevada.
I wanted to pay everybody back, but you get deeper and deeper and deeper. It's like a drug. And you're lying. You're lying all the time.
If Vinny ended up in a shallow grave, it would be an ending. It would be a happy ending.
From 2005 to 2015, Vinny Favorito was one of the rare comedians with a headlining show on the Strip. He also talked his fan base and industry connections out of more than $1 million, mostly to fuel his gambling addiction. In 2015, he lost his show, ran into legal problems, and declared bankruptcy. Detailing all of this is a new locally produced documentary, Vinny Plays Vegas. It's now available to rent online. State of Nevada producer Mike Pravat spoke with the movie's co-writer and consulting producer, Mike Weatherford, who's also a Desert Companion contributor. Weatherford covered Favorito's downfall during his time as a Las Vegas Review-Journal entertainment columnist. Here's that conversation.
Mike, welcome to State of Nevada.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Now, Mike, you have covered a lot of Vegas entertainers in your life, including Vinny Favorito. I'm wondering if you could tell us a story about Favorito's act that kind of captures his place in the pantheon of Vegas entertainment.
He was a mid-level comic that was doing really well in the 200-seat theater at the Flamingo that now hosts the ex-burlesque show. And instead of the stand-up comedy format where you buy a comedy show but you don't really know who's performing, he was a solo-billed headliner. And some would say he was kind of the heir apparent to Don Rickles. He was an insult comic who worked the room more than he did prepared monologue material.
And what is it about insult comedy that it played well here for so long? Rickles obviously had a great career here with it, and Vinny had a good 10 years here. So why did it do well here, and how would you actually describe how the format of the show goes when you are an insult comic?
I guess the buzzword as it became known was interactive. It was the unique Vegas experience. You know, you came and you just didn't sit there and watch a guy on stage passively. It's like he worked that room and he picked on every single person in the room. So you went home and you said, hey, I got picked on in a Las Vegas show. As we see in the film, it became kind of part of his racket. He actually sold customized CDs or DVDs of every show. So you could even buy that and take it home.
Now, Mike, how did you get involved with this project? What is your connection to the people involved?
Vinny's story was one I covered at the Review Journal, and it was one of the more unusual stories I ever covered because in the old days, they say that if a cocktail server had a family emergency, Frank Sinatra would take a C-note out of his pocket and say, here, go help your family. Well, this was sort of the reverse. You know, this was the entertainer borrowing from the cocktail server. And when things came to a head and blew up and Vinny lost his show, I kept getting emails and calls from more and more people that said he was owed money. And this is everybody from Emmanuel Lewis, who played Webster on TV, to Ed Bernstein, to the cocktail server and the busboy or valet parkers at the Flamingo.
Had you worked on a movie before, Mike?
I had been interviewed for a movie, but I've never been involved in making one. And that was an interesting experience. There were a lot of chefs in the kitchen and a lot of learning the hard way. But during the pandemic, when we were locked down, a lot of this sort of ended up in my lap for various reasons. And I found myself learning a lot about how documentaries are made.
Yeah, you served on three different roles for this movie. I mean, what excited you about the topic or even director Brian Burkhart's concept?
Brian came to me right after I had left the RJ And I was pondering my future and like, well, what am I going to do now? I got a lot of options here. And the Vinny story had been kicking around. I was thinking, well, maybe I could do kind of a long form magazine piece. So Brian shows up and he's like, I'm trying to make this documentary. And I'm like, perfect. You know, I think it's a good subject for that format. It was something new for me.
Now, you had mentioned some of Vinny Favorito's marks previously. They also included fellow comedians and business people, folks that were in gambling and poker circles. I mean, he really had a wide range of folks that he asked for money. I'm wondering, in your estimation, what made him so trustworthy that they gave him thousands, even tens of thousands of dollars, sometimes over and over again?
That is a question we kind of struggle with in the documentary, and I hope we fully explain it. I think the easy answer is that his photo was up on the posters in the Flamingo and his name was up in lights, so to speak. There was this element of, hey, you know I'm good for it. You know I'll pay you back. You know where to find me. You know where I am every night.
He also seems he's pretty good at laying on the charm, as the movie demonstrates. I wonder if in your experience, did you find him as charming as everyone else made him out to be?
Well, when you're involved in a documentary and you have to look and listen to him over and over again, that charm wears off. But going back to the early days of going to see his show, I enjoyed it as much as everybody else. I thought it was really unique that he worked that room. He singled everybody out. He remembered everybody's name and profession. He made jokes about that. And then at the end of the show, he'd circle around and kind of do these callbacks and tie one person to the other. And it was a really good hat trick. And then, of course, later it turned out that that was kind of the secret to it. If some guy was perceived to be like a rich attorney, then somehow that would be like, hey, after the show, you want to play golf? You want to get together? That kind of thing.
Now, you had mentioned about all the tip-offs and calls that you got from people that had been, you know, giving him money and complaining about what he was doing. You know, the Vegas entertainment and hospitality scene, they can be tight-lipped at times, or at best, tipsters may demand to remain anonymous because there's this worry that they'll be blackballed from future employment. What do you think was different about this story that you got so many people reaching out to you?
There's sort of the subculture in Vegas. We call it the grinder world in the film, and it's these kind of low-limit poker players that sort of work the system and sort of live off casino comps. And I guess it's still a thing even in this new fancy Vegas we live in now. But these guys all know each other. They all see each other. They're kind of the locals that mingle with the tourists in the poker rooms every day. And when all this blew up, their message boards, and they were all kind of networked together and they all knew about this. And somehow then I started hearing about it. But it is funny, some of the people in the film didn't know about each other. They thought they were the only one. And then when all this blew up and my stories started running in the Review Journal, they were like, oh, the same thing happened to this other guy.
Safe to say, Vinny and Las Vegas were kind of perfect for each other.
I've been around it all. I'm in the entertainer's world. There's all kinds of habits and addictions in this world. But anybody in a casino cannot say whether they're in a poker room or they're out on the floor playing the other games. It's all about action. And every one of us is degenerates. That's the bottom line.
Mike, are stories like Favorito's common in Las Vegas, where a local entertainer falls prey to gambling addiction and then things go sideways?
I guess it's part of the history of Las Vegas. In the old days, the golden age or whatever, the 60s, you always heard about comedians like Joey Lewis gambling away their whole salary at the tables and end up owing the casino money or having to have their markers erased. I guess what makes this one unusual is that it was the new Vegas and that Vinny wasn't at that caliber of a draw where the high rollers would come in and it'd be like, well, it's okay because he's bringing in the players anyway.
Now, how does the Vegas comedy and entertainment communities generally feel about Favorito now? Is he persona non grata or is there a redemption arc possible for him?
That's one of the reasons the film took so long to finish. We didn't really have an ending for it because he had left town, but we didn't really know if what would happen to him. And as it turned out, he is back in town, and he even has a show downtown at the Notoriety on Fremont Street. And he has been spotted at the South Point Poker Room, and he got into an altercation, a loud yelling match with one of the guys interviewed in the film recently.
Now, you had said at the end of the film that you would like to see him revive his career as long as it's not in Las Vegas. I'm wondering then, upon hearing that he's still performing here, if you have mixed feelings about the continuation of what he does here in town.
Now that I'm a freelancer, I don't really have to cover him, so he's not really my problem anymore. But like I say in the film, you would like to see him working and popular so he could pay all these people back. The indications we have are not in that direction.
Mike, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And now, enjoy this postcard from the wind, an audio dispatch from independent producer Phil Corbett, who's based in Northern Nevada.
The young mountain lion left the bank of the river. The lion was young, and in youth, he left to find his own territory. Perhaps one held by a distant ancestor passed on, the land opened up like a flower. A few blocks north, the calendar on the wall inside the cashier's room of the casino said August 24th, 2012. It was just before sunrise, and I imagined the scene. A man in the fluorescent room caged in with all the money, and just before his shift is over, a commotion on the edge of the casino floor. At the revolving front door, somebody was calling 911. The glass entrance normally spun like a dust devil, but the spinning had stopped. And the man explained to dispatch that there was a big animal trying to get inside. The mountain lion planted his feet in the open wedge of the paused revolving door and gazed in at the beeping, flashing machines. And then the sting of a tranquilizer dart. The lion slinked under the outdoor stage, graced the previous weekend by a tribute to the band Journey. Then, two more darts, and the mountain lion drifted off to sleep. As the sun rose, the revolving door was spinning again, round and round and round. Postcards from the Wind are produced by me, Phil Corbett. Full-length episodes at thewind.org.
There's no shortage of what to see, hear, and do at any time in Nevada. Here to filter out a few of the best options for your arts and entertainment calendar is KNPR producer Mike Prevett. He oversees the arts and culture beat for Nevada Public Radio. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Paul.
All right, so Mexican Independence Day is a pretty big deal in Las Vegas, especially in the tourist corridor, where many Spanish language artists perform during the week. I understand you have a couple recommendations for this week.
I counted no less than 27 such acts playing over the next week, and I want to highlight two lesser-known, more affordable, and maybe more alternative-sounding acts. And by the way, both of them are of Mexican descent, and I specify that because some of the others are not. One of the earlier concerts in the week is headlined by Caifanes. They go back to the mid-1980s. They ended up mixing that decade's British and American rock with touchstones of traditional and modern Mexican music, and ultimately they helped kickstart the rock and Espanol movement. They put on a great show, and I'm pretty sure they'll do that again at the Pearl on September 10th. Now, if you want something that's a little more unique, there is singer-songwriter Cuco. He incorporates more genres into his indie sound than Caifanes or pretty much anyone coming to Las Vegas this coming week. He sings in both English and Spanish, and he plays a number of instruments in his, let's call it, dream pop songs. He's going to be at the Brooklyn Bowl on September 13th.
I don't even know if 27 Touring Music Acts will play all of Reno this week, so it's a little bit different up here. But we do have a big event going on Saturday, September 13th in downtown Reno. What's that?
Sure do. Nevada Humanities is clearly not letting federal funding cuts get in the way of its event goals. The cultural institution is hosting its literary crawl, and that's happening at various businesses in the California Avenue corridor. There's going to be more than 40 different events involving 120 different authors and artists and other kinds of participants. And we're talking about panels and performances, including one on live radio and one live read-through of a play. There will also be workshops, author signings, storytelling and activities for kids, and all of it is free, though you should RSVP for this crawl, and we'll have a link to do that at knpr.org. And maybe bring a bag or two to hold all the books you are going to buy, and I'm fairly certain you will buy some.
That is absolutely right. I am definitely going to be feeding my book addiction this weekend. Tell me, what about Las Vegas? Anything big going on?
So I wouldn't call this big, but this is definitely a unique event that's coming to our arts district. It's called Tish, Tarot, and Beats. You know how there's these sing-alongs at movies? They take a popular movie that has a lot of songs in it, and everyone sort of sings along now?
I do.
Well, imagine a sing-along, no movie, but at a table. And this is a way for community members to sort of break bread and celebrate the music of various cultures that are represented in Las Vegas. The occasion is called a tish. This literally translates to table in Yiddish. And local singer-songwriter Heather Klein is going to lead this table full of singers through several lyric-free and international songs. Now, you can be any level of singer to participate. The organizers have made it pretty clear that the participants will learn these worldly melodies very easily. And the hopes is that this will foster community and celebrate diversity at a time when we are constantly being reminded of how divided we are. And per the event name, there will be tarot reading as well as snacks that bookend this musical experience. This takes place Sunday, September 14th at 6 p.m. at Art Square. But you do need to RSVP first, and we'll have a link to that at knpr.org as well.
All right. Thank you so much, Mike.
Thank you, Paul.
That's our show for this Wednesday, September 10th. Thank you so much for listening to KNPR State of Nevada. And if you like something you heard today, share it. You can find all our segments at knpr.org and on most podcast apps. I'm Paul Boger. Thank you so much for listening. This is State of Nevada.